They camped here last night, by the look of it.
Ronsard rose from the cold ashes he had been examining.
And by the look of it, there must have been close to 3,000 men, with wagons and horses.
Thedo's eyes swept the wide meadow where the army had camped. All that was left now were the scattering traces they had left behind. Matted grass where men had slept, charred patches where fires had burned, broken turf where wagons had passed, and the crescent indentations in the earth where horses had walked. But the army had moved on.
It will not be difficult to follow them. The signs are clear enough.
Ronsard cast an eye toward the westering sun.
How far do you think an army that size could travel in a day? 4 leagues? 5?
4 leagues, perhaps. Not more. They do not seem to be in any great hurry. It is strange.
What is it?
That a force of such size should move through the land, driving all before them, and yet...
not appear afraid of being met and challenged.
Esme sat on her mount, watching the two knights and following their conversation.
Yes, that's it. If I were invading a strange country, I would have a thought for the resistance which must surely come sooner or later. There is an arrogance here which chills my marrow.
Sir Ronsard, come quickly!
He has found something.
Ronsard led them to where the man knelt. Drawing closer, they soon noticed the look of frank disgust which contorted the soldier's features.
What is it, Takio? What have you found?
Lord Ronsard, someone has been killed on this spot, sir.
The soldier was right. The deep red-black stain upon the earth could have been made in only one way. Thedo eyed the evidence, his lips pressed into a thin, colorless line.
It could have been a stag.
What would they do with the body?
Ronsard turned away from the ugly splotch in the grass, and Esme noticed the dark flame of anger which leapt into his eyes.
I think I know what they did with the body.
Takio spoke so oddly, the others looked at him, and then followed his gaze to the nearby trees.
By Azrael!
The fiends!
Avert your eyes, my lady. It is no sight for a woman.
Ronsard glanced at Thedo, and his look was one of keen distress. For two heartbeats, a question hung unspoken between them.
We must, for I would know.
I will go with you. Stay here with Takio, Esme. We shall return at once.
Thedo dismounted and started off with Ronsard toward the tree, a great spreading oak wherein hung the dangling corpse of the unfortunate soldier. It did not so much resemble a human body as it did that of some animal carcass hung up to age. The birds had been all day at its face, and the entrails were but ragged shreds. It was hung from a low branch, both halves side by side, twisting slowly on the cord which passed through the bound hands and feet.
One of their own?
Aye.
Ronsard turned away from the gruesome token.
I am satisfied. Quentin and Tolly may still be alive, though I am not overconfident of such possibility.
Nor am I. But it is enough, I think, to continue the chase.
Thedo cast his eyes to the sky, now radiant with the gold of the lowering sun.
We still have a few hours of daylight. We can go far.
And we will ride tonight. We should catch them before morning.
Without another word, they walked back to where the others were now waiting, Esme and Takio having been joined by the two remaining knights.
Be assured, my lady. Yonder wretch was never friend to us. One of their own, most likely.
Ronsard shot a questioning glance at the two, who had, like Takio, been scouring the area for any signs as to the fate of the captives. Both knights merely shook their heads from side to side. They had seen nothing.
Then we ride on. The trail is an easy one to follow. We shall stop at next water to rest the horses. Norbert and Kenby, go ahead. And then Takio and Esme, Thedo and I will follow.
As the others took their mounts, Ronsard spoke to Thedo.
We must have a plan before we reach the camp.
We will pray that something presents itself along the way. I know not what we shall do else.
Two human skulls stared vacantly back at Quentin from where they stood affixed to long poles on either side of Gerd's low dais. The warlord himself seemed only a slightly more animated skull. He sat unmoving, the soft lamplight filling the hollows of his lean face with shadow. That he was aware at all of their presence was shown by the two glinting orbs of his black eyes. The warlord was seated, as were his reluctant guests, upon a cushion. His chest was bare, for he wore a short jacket open to the waist. It was of a very ornate pattern, brocaded in delicate figures foreign to Quentin's eye. But it was the man's chest which caught and held Quentin's attention, for even in the glimmering light of the oil lamps, he could see that it was a mass of scars, Long, jagged, nasty-looking scars. No accident or wound of battle could have produced them in such profusion. Some were obviously more recent, for they overlaid others, and some were only freshly healed. Quentin realized with a start that the wounds, these horrible mutilations, were self-inflicted. The Seneschal, now seated at the Warlord's right hand between the prisoners and his master, clapped his hands, and slaves bearing large bowls of food came hurrying in. Another slave set down smaller bowls, which the food bearers proceeded to fill from the larger bowls. When this was completed, the bowls were left before the diners, and the slaves withdrew hastily. The Warlord picked up his bowl and fell to eating at once, without another glance at his guests. The food was a kind of boiled grain heavily spiced, with chunks of meat and a thick sauce, and was steaming hot. It tasted exotic and otherworldly to Quentin's uninitiated palate, and once swallowed, it left a lingering warmth on the tongue. They ate with fingers, bowls held to their lips. Quentin contrived to balance his bowl on the inner pan of his knee, dipping with his left hand, his useless right arm cradled in his lap. Midway through the meal, a slave appeared with a jar and began to pour out an amber liquid into gold cannikins. These two were placed before each one, and the slave departed. The beverage was a wine of some kind. Quentin recognized the slight metallic tang, but it was of a kind he had never encountered. Smooth, almost thick, and wonderfully sweet. He found that a sip banished the warm tingle on his tongue produced by the spice of the food. The Warlord ate two bowls greedily without looking up. When he had finished, he laid down his bowl and placed his hands upon his knees.
Das Essen ist.
The meal is over.
Though Quentin's bowl was still half full, he put it down and rested his hand upon his knee in imitation of his host.
Lord Gerd wishes you to know that he only eats in the presence of those he respects, and that he will only share food with those he admires.
The emissary nodded to them, indicating that some response of like nature was intended.
Who are we that he should respect or admire us, his enemies?
Quentin listened as the emissary translated what he said, then listened as the Warlord spoke his response.
Lord Gerd says that your spirit has ennobled you. You, fair-skinned one, have survived the ordeal of the wheel. Had you been a coward, you would have died. You, dark-skinned one, risked death to rescue your friend. This deed has value, even though it is the act of a fool. The Lord Gerd admires such courage. He will be sorry to kill you when the time comes, but your blood will flow for him as a most satisfying oblation for his immortality. This pleases him.
This answer mystified and angered Quentin. He started to make a reply, but felt Toli's light touch on his arm.
Why do you invade our land? Who are you?
The Seneschal spoke to the Warlord, who smiled thinly, like a serpent.
I informed Lord Gerd that you were honored that he should deem you worthy for such service.
Quentin looked at him sharply.
It would not serve to anger him just now. He would have you disemboweled to return the food you have eaten with him.
What does he want with us?
He alone knows.
Gerd picked up his goblet and drank deeply of the sweet liquor. When he had done, he rumbled a long discourse to his emissary, who interpreted.
Lord Gerd wishes to know how far is the great city Ascalon, and how is it fortified, and by how many soldiers it is guarded.
How is it that he believes I know the answers to such questions?
After a brief consultation with his lord, the man smiled.
Lord Gerd knows that you have horses, and therefore are not unsubstantial men. He has seen your weapons and clothing, and believes that you are of favored rank. The fact that you attacked his soldiers, the two of you alone, tells him that you are not unfamiliar with military matters, and are in fact well trained for such purposes.
Quentin hesitated. Toli's thoughts could not be discerned.
If you are pondering whether to answer or not, please allow me to remind you that Lord Gerd perceives any answers following such reluctance to be a lie, as I have already told you. Give me your answer at once, and he will be appeased.
Ascalon is a far distance from here, many leagues. And he is right to call it a great city, for so it is. There is none like it. No host has ever conquered Castle Ascalon, and none ever will.
And how many soldiers defend this place?
Tell your Lord Gerd that the Dragon King's army is sufficient to any need.
The Warlord watched this exchange closely, not entirely pleased with Quentin's response, but he nodded with satisfaction when his interpreter had finished his reply. Gerd beamed at Quentin and Toli.
Ich habe mich lassen. Nice leben.
The Lord Gerd is pleased with your answers. He has decided to allow you to live until we reach Ascalon, where you will be sacrificed in order that he might win the city more quickly. He wishes to assure you that your blood will flow for him alone. This is a very high honor.
It is an honor that we would rather forego. But perhaps we may reciprocate the distinction at some future time.
The emissary smiled slyly and began to offer Quentin's remarks to his master, who bowed faintly. Lord Gerd waved his hand toward his servant, who stood.
The audience is now at an end. Bow to him and retreat. Do not show your back to him.
They all backed away from the warlord's presence through the curtain. They crossed the tent and stepped once more outside. The evening was deepening, and Quentin felt the atmosphere in the camp pulsing with a barely contained excitement. The soldiers clustered together in knots. The sun was well down, and the sky blushed crimson in the west.
This night there will be wild celebration, for it is Henrutha, the night of animal spirits.
You speak our language well, sir.
A sly look came into the dark eyes.
I speak 11 languages very well.
What did you say in there?
Quentin spoke as his former guards hurried up to take them away. The warlord's personal servant smiled, revealing a row of fine white teeth that seemed to glow in the fading light.
I told him that it was an honor you would gladly repay in kind. He was flattered.
Why should you protect us? What is it to you if we live or die?
There is no time to explain. I will come to you tonight when the chaos is at its peak.
The emissary spun on his heel and went back into the tent. Quentin and Tolly were marched away to the wagons once more, but this time Quentin felt as if they moved in an aura of increased respect. The looks they received from the soldiers they passed were frankly awed to the point of reverence. He guessed that most who were summoned to the tent did not walk out, but they had. A few curious guests strolled the gallery to marvel at the interior of Castle Ascalon. Without appearing to be in haste, Derwin nevertheless hurried along to the king's apartment. He had little doubt that he would find Escobar there. Oswald was at the door when Derwin came bustling along.
Oswald, is all well?
Oswald ducked his head in a shallow bow.
Aye, my lord. The king is inside and the queen with him. He has a messenger.
Who?
I know not. I did not see him arrive. The warder brought him hither at once.
Very well. Let us see then what is afoot.
Oswald opened the door and went in. As Derwin made to follow the old chamberlain, he felt a light touch on his arm.
Bria, I thought you were in the garden.
I followed you. What is it?
A messenger has come, that is all. Wait here but a little and I will come and tell you all I can.
No, I would go with you.
Bria stepped through the doorway and pulled Derwin with her.
Ah, Derwin, I was about to send for you.
Escobar sat in a great carved chair. Alenia stood beside him with her hand on his shoulder. Both were looking intently at the knight, bedraggled and exhausted, his clothing and light armor grimed over with the dust of the road. The soldiers stood swaying with fatigue before them.
It is Martrand, one of Ronsard's knights. He was just about to tell us his message.
The knight bowed.
Lord Ronsard says, we are continuing on our mission and are sorry for the delay in returning to Ascalon. We will come hence as soon as we are satisfied that we have obtained that which we seek, or have some better report to bring.
Is that all, sir knight? You may speak freely.
That is all, sire. That is my message.
Escobar, his eyes displaying sad concern, stroked his chin with his hand.
Why did he send you with such a message, brave knight?
I believe that he was worried that his long absence would cause you alarm. Thedo, it was, suggested a message be carried back that they might continue their errand.
Why was that? Have you seen nothing to render an account?
No, sire. We saw nothing out of the ordinary. But...
But what, good fellow? Have no fear. There is nothing you can say that will incur your king's displeasure. Withholding your thoughts, however, could be a mistake. Please, speak and allow us to judge.
Yes, sir. It is this. I sensed that something was bothering my lords. They were looking for something and finding it not. This upset Thedo greatly. He pushed a furious pace. He wanted to ride all night on occasion. But Ronsard would not let him. They often had words with one another over it, but I saw something which puzzled me on the way back. I think that if Thedo had seen it, he would have been even more adamant in his ways.
And what did you see?
One of the villages we had passed through only a day or so before was empty when I rode back through. I thought it strange that I did not see anyone, though I did not stop to look further into the matter.
Empty?
Yes, sir. It was completely abandoned.
Anything else? Anything to indicate why that should be so?
Not at all. It seemed as if it had been deserted very quickly, though no cause could I see. But, like I say, I did not stop to wonder at it. I came on.
I see. Very well, Martha. You may go to your bed. You have well earned your rest. Oswald, take Sir Martrand to the kitchen and feed him, and then find him a bed in the castle where he will not be disturbed. Good Martrand, stay close about. I may wish to question you further. Now go and take your ease.
Just one more thing, sir. You did not say that you met Quentin and Tolly on the road. Yet you must have passed them at some point. They left here in search of your party a fortnight ago.
I passed no one at all. And I thought that strange as well, for until I reached Hinsenby, the roads were mine alone.
Thank you, Martran. Sleep well.
Derwin fixed a wondering look at the king.
His tale is queer indeed. I do not know what to make of it.
It is as I have said. There are strange happenings in the land. An evil grows, but we see it not.
But what has happened to Quentin?
We do not know, my lady. But the land is great. They may have traveled by another route.
At any rate, we will soon know. I propose to go myself in search of them.
Say not so, my lord. You have not yet recovered enough strength to abide the saddle.
Go if you would, sire. It is your pleasure. But in going, you risk missing the return of your envoy. And where would you begin searching for them?
Escavar threw a wounded look at the hermit.
What am I to do? I cannot remain here forever, waiting while the enemy grows stronger.
No one has seen an enemy.
You think he does not exist? He does. I can feel him in my heart. He is coming. I can feel it.
All the more reason to wait. Gain your strength. The action you seek will come soon enough if you are right.
Mensendor cries out for her protector, but he sits abed and quakes with fear. Who will save us from our weakness?
Leave him now. I will tend him. This is the duty of a wife and queen.
By your leave, my lady. I will withdraw to my chambers. Send for me should you need anything.
Derwin took Bria by the arm and drew her from the room.
I have never seen him thus.
It is a most difficult time for him, and he is not a man much accustomed to difficulty. But worry not on it, for I saw signs of his spirit returning. He will be the Dragon King once more.
The great hand closed over the small white body of the bird. Nin the Immortal felt the swift beating of the tiny heart and the dove's soft warm body filling his hand. The yellow beak opened wide. The tiny head rolled to the side. Nin, whose fleets stretched the breadth of Gerfallon, opened his hand slowly. The bundle of feathers in his hand shivered and lay still. He flung the dead bird across the room, where it landed near the door of his chamber. A flurry of white down floated gently to the floor, to settle like snowflakes around the lifeless body. Uzla's head peered around the edge of the door.
Immortal one, I bring news.
The minister's eyes strayed to the small white lump of feathers on the floor before him.
And speak.
Uzla tiptoed in and prostrated himself before his master.
Rise! Your god commands you speak, Uzla. Let your voice utter pleasing words of worship to the Eternal One.
Oh, it's like our Nin. How shall I describe his greatness? For it is more brilliant than the shining deeds of men, and his wisdom endures forever.
Your words please me. Tell me now, what is your news? Has Ascalon been taken? I am becoming impatient with this waiting. Tell me what I wish to hear, Usla.
My news is perhaps better suited to a different time and place, most noble Nin. I know not of Ascalon, but may it be as you say.
What then? Tell me quickly, I grow tired of your foolishness.
The commander of your fleet below Mensendor sends word of victory. The ships of King Tron have been destroyed, and the battle on land is begun.
The great hairless face split into a wide smile of satisfaction. The flesh of his cheeks rolled away on either side, like mountains forming alongside a deep chasm. His dark, baleful eyes shrank away to tiny black pits, and his chin sank into the folds on his neck.
It is well. How many prisoners were sacrificed to me?
I know not, Infinite Majesty. The commander did not say, but we may deduce, I think, that it was a very great number. It is ever thus.
True. I am pleased. I will have a feast to celebrate.
May I dare to remind the supreme light of the universe that it is Hagenrutha. There is already a feast tonight. It is being prepared even now.
Ah, yes, how suitable. Go then and bring me word when all is in readiness. And command the slaves to ready my oil bath. I will be anointed before my celebration begins. My subjects will fill their eyes with my splendor tonight. It is my will for them. Hear and obey.
Uzla fell on his face once more, and then backed out of the room. Nin raised his round moon of a face. Those who heard the laughter shuddered. Who among them would be asked to provide for the immortal one's amusement tonight? Whoever chanced to serve that honor on the night of Hagenrutha likely would not see another morning. The Tower of Flames leapt high into the night, pouring itself into the vast darkness above, blotting out the stars in the scarlet glow. Quentin and Tolly, tethered to the wagon's wheels, could feel the heat of the enormous bonfire on their faces, though they were well removed from the blaze. As the flames soared skyward, the wild revel rose on its own wicked wings, taking the form of a thing fevered and inflamed. The tumult had grown steadily through the evening hours, and now the surrounding woods echoed with the crazed ravings of the celebrants. The raging mass seethed about the fire in gyrations of ever-increasing frenzy. To Quentin and Tolly, looking on in mute wonder, it seemed as if something had taken control of their spirits and played them as a maddened minstrel striking his instrument in tortured ecstasy. Quentin saw in the glare thrown out by the fire something moving in the darkness beyond the perimeter. Through the shimmering sheets of heat loosed by the fire, he could see it lumbering. The shape moved slowly like a colossal beast, a dark shape which seemed to form itself out of the darkness surrounding it.
Tolly, look yonder, there across the way.
What is it? I cannot make it out.
Wait, it's coming closer.
No sooner had Quentin finished speaking than the creature emerged from its dark captivity into the roiling circle of light. It loomed large in the dancing light, the glow of the flames glittering on its hideous black skin. It was a creature of terrible beauty, awful and tremendous. It looked a very denizen of Hoth's forsaken underworld, a thing distilled out of a thousand nightmares. And it came lurching out of the forest into the midst of the celebrants, as if it had been called up from the depths of its underworld home to reign as lord over the foul Hagenrutha. At first, Quentin believed it to be alive, but as the thing moved closer, he saw that it was in fact pulled along with ropes by a hundred or so of its keepers who clustered about its feet. At last they brought it to the fire's brink, where it stood with hands outstretched in a perpetual blessing, or curse. It was a statue, an immense carven image of a beast with the legs and torso of a man, the head of a lion, and the maw of a jackal. Two great curving horns swept out from either side of its head, and its mouth was open in a snarl of rage.
It is their idol.
The ground fairly trembled with a pandemonium. Their two guards jumped up and began dancing where they stood, waving their arms with ravished abandon. Now more wood was being thrown around the base of the statue, and it was being induced into the flames. As Quentin and Tully watched the flames encircle the monstrous idol, a shadow detached itself from among the myriad flickering projections and crept toward them along the perimeter.
I am going to cut your hands free. Do not move.
Quentin did as instructed and felt his bonds fall away. His right arm swung limply down. He gathered it up with his left hand and held it close to his chest. Without waiting for further instruction, he rolled to cover beneath the wagon. The three met, heads together, under the shelter of the wagon box. Tully rubbed his wrists.
Why are you doing this?
There was a brief flash of white in the darkness as the warlord's emissary smiled.
They are my captors too. I have long planned to escape, but if I am to survive, I will need the help of those who know this country.
The emissary looked at both of them, his eyes glinting in the firelight.
Time is short. We must go.
Away from the wagons, there was little chance of discovery. The three crouching figures worked their way around the rim of the camp, darting furtively through the mingling expanses of light and darkness. In the trees around them, the huge elongated shadows cavorted in grotesque mummery as the savage rites progressed unabated. It was slow work threading through the circle's outer ring, but at last they managed to reach the shelter of the wood, where the shadows gathered over them like a cloak.
I have hidden our horses just there.
The seneschal nodded into the further darkness beyond.
I was able to retrieve your steed, but yours could not be found.
Tully grinned.
It was not my horse. I took it from among the others at Tether.
Even in the dark, Quentin could see their guide's eyebrows arch upward in surprise, and his eyes shine in amused disbelief.
And I was right about you two, after all. You are not without considerable resources yourselves. I have chosen my partners well.
The air seemed cooler in the woods, and they moved with increased confidence. Quentin shivered inwardly and fought to keep pace with the others. By the time they reached the horses, waiting patiently in a small grass-covered draw, Quentin was panting and weak. The modicum of strength he had been able to scrape together was nearly exhausted.
I know a way out of the wood if you will follow me. Then it is I who will follow you.
Very well. Lead on.
In the moonlight softly filling the draw, Tully saw the film of sweat glistening on Quentin's brow.
Ride with me. I can take us both.
Once we are away from here, I will be all right. Hurry now. Help me into the saddle. There is no time to argue.
Tully caught his master's foot and hoisted him onto the mount. He could see that Quentin's right arm dangled uselessly from his shoulder. Quentin grabbed the reins with his left hand and drew his right across his lap to tuck it beneath his cloak.
Let us away.
Tully sprang to his mount, and they were off, the horses heading into the wood. Blazer seemed none the worse for his adventure. Quentin was relieved to be in his own saddle once again. At least with Blazer, he did not need two hands to ride. The horse would anticipate the commands of his master. Quentin had only to hang on, and that was something he desperately hoped he would be able to do. In a moment, they were in the deep wood, where the thick columns of trees broke the silver moonlight and scattered it in slivers all around. Behind them, like the voices heard in dreams, the cries of the revelers wailed on, diminishing rapidly as distance and the thick growth of wood cut them off.
It is a dream.
Quentin chased the elusive shapes before him, flitting in and out of shadow and light.
An awful dream that would be forgotten upon awakening.
It is time something is done.
The High Priest of Ariel paced his bare cell.
It is time to act.
The thick candle guttered in the swirl stirred up by Bjorkus's passing to and fro. A stack of parchment scrolls teetered precariously upon the table.
It is time. It is time.
Bjorkus heaved himself through the door of his cell and into the darkened passageway beyond. He ran through the empty temple and passed through a side entrance used only by the priests. He hopped across a moonlit courtyard and through a narrow portal in the wall, then stood alone on the edge of the plateau and looked out across the silent valley below. He turned and cast his old eyes, still sharp as blades, toward the eastern sky. The moon was overhead, but in the east, a star blazed brightly, more brilliant than any of its sisters. And around the glowing star, a film of light seemed to gather, streaming out from the star's core. The portion of the night where that star was fixed shone with pale radiance, and wherever the eye roamed in examination of Night's Black Dome, it was drawn back to that star, the Wolf Star.
Yes! Yea, it is time to act!
Dokas turned, fled over the jumble of rocks, and swept back through the courtyard and into the temple once more. He made his way along on short, stout legs to one of the temple's many summons gongs. He picked up the striker and paused for one final instant of reflection.
That will bring them running.
He was right. In a moment, the vestibule was filled with sleepy priests, who rubbed their eyes at the disturbance to their slumbers.
Fellow priests, my bed has remained empty these two nights running. You can bear with me this little while. I wish to speak to you.
What is this, Bjorkis? Why have you called us from our devotions?
Your snoring vespers are not important. It is time to act. The star which shines without, growing bigger with each passing night, I know now what it means.
And this could not wait until morning?
The speaker was Pluel, the under-high priest, his own assistant. He at least had the privilege, as Bjorkis had once had, of questioning the high priest.
I think not. It has waited too long already. While we have blindly contemplated its meaning at our leisure, the star has grown large, and with it the strength of the evil it betokens. Menzendor is under siege from forces from far countries. The world we know is trembling on the brink of destruction.
I am surprised to hear that you are so concerned, Bjorkis. It is not like you at all. You are the one who has ever instructed us of the folly of considering the commerce of mortal kings and their petty concerns. It does alarm me to hear you speak so now. Should we not draw aside, you and I, and discuss this together?
Why, Pluel, do I sense in your tone the shriek of ambition? Why should not our brothers hear what I have to say?
The under-high priest stepped toward his mentor, placing a hand on his arm as if he would lead him aside.
This is not the time to display such ill-founded airs before our assembled brothers. Come aside. You are tired, and your vigil has made you somewhat, shall we say, irrational.
Irrational indeed! I have never been so lucid in my long and eventful life. But I do not understand your manner at all. Why do you look at me so?
It is late, brothers. Return to your cells and to your rest. We will no doubt have a more fruitful discussion tomorrow.
I am High Priest! Have you forgotten? All of you, stay where you are and hear me. I propose to send King Escavar word of our discovery.
Your discovery, Bjorkis? You cannot expect us to endorse it, surely?
Suddenly, Bjorkis realized what was happening. Pluel's overreaching ambition, long held in check, was now released. He was making his move to take over the High Priesthood. Bjorkis trembled with rage as the realization knifed through him.
What a fool I have been! While I have lain awake seeking an answer to the riddle of yonder star, he has been scheming all along. It shall not be, viper! Take your hand from me! Hear me, brothers! I am High Priest, and long have you known me. When have I ever proposed a thing unwisely or brought dishonor to the god whom we serve? Why should my suggestion of a message to the king cause such concern for some of our brothers? What does anyone have to fear of my sending word to our monarch? Unless there is a reason why they would keep all knowledge of the events to come to themselves. Unless they will remove the High Temple from its place as servant to the subject of the realm.
Oh, how you do go on, Bjorkis. There is nothing at all to prevent your communicating with the king, if you like.
Of course not. I am High Priest. A journey to Ascalon is within the authority of my sacred vows, for I will it so to be. I would grant this same authority to any who served me in the matter.
Why not go, then, and make the trip for yourself?
I am old, and a younger man could travel the faster. I will set my seal to a letter to be carried by one whom I will choose.
I do not think you will find any who would as eagerly cast aside their vows as you would have them.
They would not violate their vows. I have already said as much. Why do you persist in this?
Bjorkus felt suddenly weak and sick. Somewhere, though Bjorkus had not seen it, the crafty Plul had turned the discourse to his advantage. The High Priest knew he was doomed, though he couldn't see how.
Who better than the High Priest should go and speak to the King? Let your own lips bear your tidings.
Very well. I will go. Who will come with me?
Bjorkus glared around the circle of bewildered faces. No one volunteered.
What? Will no one accompany the High Priest on this arduous journey? I could order all of you to go.
Maybe now we should come aside and talk.
Plul seemed to glow with satisfaction.
I have nothing more to say to you.
Bjorkus raised his rod and brought it down upon the stone floor at his feet.
As you will, brother. Then I have no other choice but to inform the priests of Ariel of the transgressions committed by the High Priest and ask for their recommendation.
What transgressions? Name them! I am not afraid. In all my life as a priest, I have ever been faithful to my vows and to the god.
You force my hand. Hear then, all priests!
Plul nodded to a priest who had drawn close. The priest handed over a scroll, which Plul took, and made a great show of unrolling. He then began reading off a list of imaginary crimes which Bjorkus was alleged to have committed against the temple, and his vows. The priests looking on appeared divided. Some nodded their agreement of the charges, others wore looks of astonishment and disbelief. When Plul was finished, he turned to Bjorkus.
What do you have to say to these indictments?
Azrael, take your indictments. There is no truth in them. Any who know me can tell you that. But I do not think it matters at all what I say. You have already made up your mind how this will end. Get on with it.
Plul turned to the assembly.
You have heard with your own ears that he does not deny the charges. There is but one recommendation we can bring. Bjorkus is to be stripped of his priesthood, and a new high priest assume his duties. Bjorkus is to be cast out from among us. Are there any who would gainsay these recommendations?
No one moved a muscle. The moment passed, and Plul turned to Bjorkus.
I am sorry it had to end this way. It would have been better for you to have gone all the way alone while you had the chance. I would have spared you this indignity.
Spare me not, foul friend. I will go at once. But hear me ere I leave, all you priests of Ariel. Evil has this night entered the temple. It will destroy each one of you if you do not pluck it out and cast it aside at once.
In response to a signal from Plul, four temple guards came forward with torches. They took Bjorkus by the arms.
I am going. But remember my words, all of you. The land is fallen under a shadow. Soon no place will be safe, not even the High Temple of Ariel. If you will not follow me and do what must be done, at least look upon the one whom you have chosen and know him for what he is. The people of the realm will seek your protection and bid the god to defend them. You will not be able to do it, for your prayers will not be heard.
Take him away! He is raving again!
The temple guards hauled their former leader down the long stone steps of the temple and pushed him into the courtyard. Bjorkus stumbled a few steps away, and then turned toward his accusers, who had spilled out upon the steps to watch him go. The white-haired man raised his rod of office, which the guards had neglected to wrest from him.
The end of the age is upon us! Look to yourselves for your salvation! The gods will not help you! This temple will not stand!
If eyes and ears do not deceive, the enemy lies encamped in yonder wood.
Ronsard leaned heavily on the pommel of his saddle, staring down onto the wooded plain below them, black and forbidding in the moonlight.
It would stand a fair wager, I will warrant.
Thedo, too, was tired and arched his back to stretch weary muscles. Ronsard's knights had dismounted and now walked to draw the stiffness from their legs. Only Esme seemed as fresh as when they had begun so early that morning.
What rites require such observance?
We can but guess, my lady. But perhaps it is the better for us. We may creep in closer while they spend themselves in their savage revel.
If Quentin and Tolly are down there, we will find them. We may as well make a start. My lady, if you would care to remain here until we return for you, it would fair ease my mind.
Have no fear for me, brave sir. I will do my part. Perchance you will need what little service I can render. My arm is not as strong as yours, but my blade is sharp as a serpent's tooth, and quicker still.
As you wish. I shall not discourage you. It does seem most apparent that you can take care of yourself. Follow then, and do what I direct. Be mounted, knights! We will approach the wood single file. Keep blades and shield covered. We will leave our horses in the wood and come to the camp on foot. If all goes well with us, we may escape undetected.
Lord Ronson, someone flees the wood as you speak. See there, along that gully beyond the trees.
I see it. There are three of them. Do you think...
Thedo looked at Ronsard hopefully.
It would do to find out who they are, at least.
Ronsard watched the three figures riding away from the wood with some speed. They were pale shapes floating over the gray sea of long grass just above the black line of a dry watercourse some distance away.
I think we may meet them. Just there.
Ronsard pointed with a gloved hand toward a bend where the gully swerved around the base of a hill.
Come, let us see who it is that flees the foul host by night.
Quentin clung to the saddle by force of will. He felt drained and used up. All strength had been wrung out of him in the escape. So he clutched at the horn of his saddle and hung on as Blazer jounced and jostled along. To his dazed mind, it seemed as if he had entered a dream in which hills and sky and woods became his pursuers, crying after him with shrieks of rage and fury. In his waking dream, he saw an army emerge from the hills above him to come sweeping down upon their flank. The dream knights came thundering down to intercept them. He could see their faces hard in the moonlight and could feel the hot breath of the horses on his face as they drew nearer as if by magic. But there was something odd about the dream. Quentin threw himself down along the horse's neck in an effort to maintain his precarious balance. Bending low, he looked along Blazer's flank behind him and saw that two riders descended into the shallow gully. Another leapt it and came on. In that moment of inattention, Quentin's mount spurred ahead and stumbled over a rock protruding from the hill. On impact, the air rushed out of Quentin's lungs, and the knights suddenly flashed in a blaze of brilliant stars, their scintillating rays stabbing through his brain.
Quentin!
Tolly wheeled around to come after him, but it was too late. When Quentin turned again, the first of their pursuers came pounding up.
Quentin! By the gods' beards, Quentin!
He shook his head dazedly. He passed his hand in front of his eyes.
Who is it?
Thedo! Is it true?
The voice was Tolly's, and in an instant, the Jair was beside Quentin.
Thedo!
Quentin could speak no more. He sank back as heavy vapors of darkness covered him, his consciousness receding swiftly. He struggled to keep his eyes open, but his lids had grown leaden, and there was no fight left in him. It seemed that he had grown light as down, for he felt himself borne up as on a sudden gust to ride on the wings of the wind. The touch of a cool hand on his brow brought Quentin out of the deepest sleep he had ever known.
See there! He has come back. Hoth would not have him.
He opened his eyes to see a ring of faces grinning down on him. Esme's pretty brow wrinkled in concern, quickly giving place to relief.
There seems to be no escaping you.
Quentin strained to sit up.
We knew you could not long elude us. By Ariel, it is good to see you.
Ronsard, Thedo, I must still be dreaming. How did you find us?
It is no dream, young sir. You must know that if not for this young woman...
Ronsard nodded to Esme sitting next to him.
We would have passed by on our way to Ascalon and never known you were there. And if we hadn't found you, you may not have escaped considering your weakened condition.
You came back.
I had to protect my protectors, did I not?
Esme's sudden smile seemed to warm him from within.
Besides, I had already lost one escort, and I was determined not to lose another.
Her dark eyes suddenly welled with tears.
Forgive me for leaving you, sir. When I saw you pulled from your horse, I wanted to help you, but I could think only of my errand. I am sorry.
Tully thrust his head in among those gathered around him. The smell of food that he brought with him reminded Quentin how hungry he was.
Eat, Kenta. We have already done so. We will talk while you break fast.
Tully set a steaming bowl before him, and Quentin fell to it with a ready appetite.
Mirmior has been telling us of your captivity. You have much to thank him for.
Mirmior?
You mean he has risked his life to bring you out of the enemy's camp and you do not know his name?
There was not time enough for such pleasantries. We were quite busy with staying alive, and only half succeeding at that.
This one has a strong will to survive. I am glad to know you, Lord Quentin.
I am no lord, Mirmior.
Better than that. He is the king's own son.
His ward.
Ward or son, I see I have chosen well the man to save. From now on, my lords, I am at your service. It will be an insult if you do not allow me to serve you in whatever ways you will.
You have done service enough for the Dragon King. Your reward is yours to name, once we have reached Ascalon and King Escavar hears of how you have rescued his own from certain death.
I was looking out for myself, sir. I, too, was held against my will by the terrible Ningal. The risk was but a small one for me, even at that. Whatever gods rule this land, they have poured out their favor upon this one. I have never seen a man survive the wheel, and it was that which allowed me to convince Gerd to spare your life. And you...
Mirmior turned to Tully.
Your failed attempt at rescue nearly cost my head as well as your own, but Mirmior is nothing if not resourceful. I turned it to advantage. Though you had to endure the anguish of seeing the guard's execution and fearing the imminence of your own.
It was at least less severe than the execution itself would have been.
How did you come to be in the company of the... What did you call them? The Ningal?
The name Ningal means the terror of Nin, his army. It is no secret how I came to be among them, but it is a story I would rather tell to your Dragon King.
There is much that you might tell, I would wager. But the sun is well up, and I think we must put as many leagues between us and the Ningal as may be. The Dragon King awaits in Ascalon, and we must not forget the fearful tidings we bring. There will be much to discuss when we sit down together. For now, it is enough that we reach the king as quickly as possible.
My thoughts exactly, fair friend.
Quentin cannot ride in his condition, surely. If you like, I will remain with him and come hence on the morrow when he is more able to withstand the journey.
Ronsard pulled on his chin.
I did not think that he would be unable to...
I can ride. I am well enough.
To show he meant what he was saying, Quentin fought to his feet, where he swayed uncertainly. He took two steps and pitched forward.
It is your arm, isn't it? You cannot move it.
Quentin rose to his knees, cradling his arm.
It will be all right. It's nothing.
It is enough. Why did you not say something?
Thedo bent to examine the injured limb. It was swollen and discolored, and hot to the touch.
Well, we can do nothing for it here, but I like not the look of it. Perhaps Tully and Esme should remain behind with you.
Though I must confess I like that even less.
No one will remain behind, and my master will not ride. Ronsard, send two knights to bring me two young birches. I will fashion a litter for him.
Excellent! I might have known you would have a solution, good Tully. My knights will fetch you whatever you need.
Despite Quentin's protests, which grew feebler with time, the litter was constructed after the style used by the nomadic Jair. The finished litter was strapped to Blazer, and before the sun had traveled an hour's time, the party set off once more toward Ascalon. Esme rode Blazer. Quentin fumed at being trundled off like so much baggage, but his fussing was mostly for show. Inwardly, he was grateful to Tully for providing him with a means to rest along the way. For despite his assurance to Thedo, Quentin was deeply worried about his arm. He couldn't move it at all. In fact, he could not feel it. When he had fallen in the underbrush on the night of their unsuccessful escape, something had snapped. He remembered it vividly, and all feeling had fled. And with it, the ability to move the limb. The arm was numb, from shoulder to fingertips. The weary party quitted the forest they had been traveling through all day. The sun was lowering in a scarlet haze among flaming clouds as they stepped out of the sheltering boughs upon the hard-packed trail, which would lead them to Ascalon's gates.
Tonight, we will sleep in proper beds with fresh linen, and we will dine in the hall of the Dragon King.
I would that it were with lighter hearts than our own that we came hence. Alas, I rue the tidings we must lay upon his shoulders. It is a burden I would not wish on any man.
There will be burden for all of us, I think.
Presently, the travelers rounded a bend in the road and came to the edge of a broad, shallow valley. Across the valley rose the great dome of rock upon which stood the castle Ascalon, transformed in the gloaming into a city of light. The long shadow stretching across the length of the valley had not reached the foundation rock of Ascalon. The castle rose out of the purple shadow and glinted in the ruby light, a jewel with soaring spires and towers and graceful bartizans perched upon high walls.
Oh, it is beautiful! I never dreamed!
A god's very palace! It is a wonder mortals dare intrude. It far outshines even its own legends.
Quentin gazed proudly upon the magnificent structure, rosy in the deepening blue of the twilight sky. Tolly, riding beside his master all the way, sat on his horse unmoved and stared at the twinkling jewel across the fair valley.
What do you say, Tolly? We are nearly home.
It does appear now to be as far as ever it was when we began this journey.
As usual, Tolly was seeing something very different than the others. And Quentin had learned it was no use trying to find out what the chair meant by these mystical pronouncements. Ronsard, at the head of the party, urged his mount forward. The others followed him down the gentle slope as the feathery wisps of evening mist began rising in the cool valley. From somewhere in the stillness, a bird winged homeward to the nest. And all at once, a sadness came over the party. To Quentin, it seemed that some final word had been spoken, and he was indeed seeing Ascalon as it would never appear again.
The Dragon King Trilogy, The Warlords of Nin Part 1, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2007, Stephen Lawhead. Published by arrangement with Thomas Nelson Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2011 by The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. With performances by Thomas Keegan, David Coyne, Dylan Lynch, Joe Brack, Andy Clements, Tim Getman, Lily Beacon, Karen Novak, Elizabeth Jernigan, James Konacek, Terrence Aselford, Scott McCormick, Michael Glenn, Christopher Sheeran, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, Eric Messner, Christopher Graybill, Johann Detweiler, and Michael John Casey. Adapted and directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Richard Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed The Warlords of Nin, be sure to look for R.A. Salvatore's Demon Wars Saga and Brent Week's Night Angel Trilogy. Available now in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for exciting previews of other graphic audio material.
Lucky you, Danny. You've got an admirer or two. Or 100.
I just blew into town and already people want to kill me.
Not kill. Capture. Alive and unharmed.
This is my hunt. You are not taking over. Is that clear?
If she is harmed, I will kill all in my path.
So what's this grand idea of yours?
You may not like it.
Does it give me a better chance of killing Santino?
It does. Yet, you do not trust me, Dante.
I don't trust anyone, not until proven. My jury's still out until you tell me this idea.
Very well. I would wish to give you a gift, a piece of my power. It will make you stronger, faster, less easy to damage.
What's the catch?
I am not sure you would wish to be tied to me so closely. And the process is difficult for humans. Painful.
You would... what? Make me into a demon?
Not a demon. My Hedera.
I've never heard of that.
It's not spoken of. It... It requires a... physical bond.
You mean like tantric? Like sex magic?
Very similar.
Oh. What? My entire body burned, changing. No! I hate you. Change me back. I don't want this. Change me back.
I cannot. You have a demon to hunt, Dante.
Santino! I've come to kill you, you scavenger son of a bitch, for what you did to Doreen.
You can't kill me! Neither man nor demon can kill me! Lucifer assured me of that!
Don't miss Dante Valentine, Working for the Devil, Part 2. It's one hell of an adventure. And it's available now in graphic audio.
Graphic Audio presents Vampire Earth.
Val, you're free to ask Peter here whatever you like. We don't know much about this. We're holding nothing back.
You think I'm on an assignment?
We know you work with cover stories and so on.
No, it's what I told you. I'm inquiring for a friend, a fellow officer, William Post. This isn't prep for an operation, not by a long shot.
It's just that the mule list is a bit of a mystery to us, too. We thought that maybe someone was finally looking into it.
Mule list?
Mule list is a term we use because all these women appear to carry something the Kurians are interested in. We know it's not blood type or anything obvious, like Downs. About all we know is that only women are tested, and that if they come up positive for it, they're immediately packed up and shipped off.
Okay, Jackson Fu. I give up. You win. What do you want? What did I ever do to you?
No, this is purely professional. I need to know about a certain train.
I deal with dozens of trains a week, man. How am I supposed to...
Listen to the question. A train. A special train. Not deposits. All women on board, routed through Memphis. Some sort of medical test selected them. Maybe joining with similar trains.
I don't know anything about a train like that. Let me go, and I'll find out for you.
Looks like you girls are gonna get to watch after all. Bring it in, Smokey.
What's that?
A big bull grog rooster. You better dig deep in your memory before our bully boy gets deep into you, rooster.
You can't mean... Oh, no.
He thinks you're a female in estrus, rooster.
Holy shit, that's big! Pimp, my forearm's got nothing on this grog.
Stop him!
You're a hard guy to find, Valentine.
Sir, please turn around and put your hands behind you.
What's this about?
You're under arrest for murder.
Murder?
Sorry, Major. Orders.
David, what's going on?
It's gotta be a mistake. Nice scouting.
Hope they don't climb up there.
Plan of nothing. Never been in here to scavenge. I'd be shocked if there wasn't a hole in the roof of most of these places. Valentine, help me hold this. No, the plastic can. They're trying to crawl over. Girl, check the back. There might be a door. Oh, shit.
There's a door, or there isn't. That's the problem.
How many?
How many are there?
Thousands!
Sounds about right.
Vampire Earth, Book 5, Valentine's Exile.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.